Greetings. I am Sav Chagrin, podcast guru and president of the Podfix Network. Since revealing myself as the puppeteer of the Podfix Nation, I have felt the need to be more hands-on with the day-to-day operations. Therefore, every Thursday, I will be opening the Podfix Archives. An absolute museum for your ears. And best of all, it is curated by none other than myself, Sav Chagrin, and no one else. I will be blowing the dust off my personally hand-pressed vinyl copies of original airings of classic Podfix Network episodes, uploading them to the satellites, and then rebroadcasting them to the masses. Sure, it's a lot of extra work, but one thing I have learned over the years is that digital media converted to vinyl converted back to digital is the way podcasts were meant to be heard. And since I, Sav Chagrin, have done all the heavy lifting for you, you just need to subscribe today to Podfix Presents wherever the best podcasts in the world are found. And then sit back, relax, and enjoy. The Podfix Network, artist-owned and loved.
I'm gonna do the whole episode like this.
Hell yeah.
God, that would kill me.
Just imagine how Christian Bale feels.
No.
Do you think he regrets?
Like he did it once, like, I'm gonna try this. And they were like, yes. Christopher Nolan was all like, yes, do that. And he's like, oh no. Like, now I'm committed to two more movies of this.
He thought it was like, just like, oh, we'll see how it is. And this is way off. But they were like, oh yeah, no, I like that. And now he's stuck with it. Hello and welcome to The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. I am Austin Rude and I'm the son.
And I'm Phil Rude and I'm the dad. Every week we watch a movie, then we get on mic to talk about it.
That's true. This is a podcast.
That would be,
and we do that.
Kind of what we do.
Yeah, it's a little bit of the point.
Bring your chair a little closer. There you go. Sorry.
So, before we get to what we watched for the podcast this week, there's something we both kind of watched,
yeah,
just for fun, which is, you know, people don't normally do that, watch movies just for entertainment.
I know, it's so weird.
It's just to tear
them apart. Why would you do it?
It's
like going out to dinner and not posting a picture of your food on Instagram. What's the point? Sustenance?
If my followers don't know I ate it, I didn't eat.
Yeah, they think I don't eat.
It's really weird. But yeah, we watched
Dune. Yeah. You watched it twice.
I did.
I mean, it's impressive that you had that much time.
And I still half understand it. I only half understand
it. It's a dense movie. It's a big idea movie, I think.
Yeah. It's a lot of work in pieces.
Yeah. What'd you think? I mean, you did watch it twice. I assume you liked it.
I did. I didn't connect with it fully until like halfway through the first time. So I felt like that was like a bad first watch. And I was like, well, I need to try this again.
Yeah.
Because I was just so excited about it. I was like, they kept pushing the marketing of this movie on me. And I was like, fine, I'll watch it. just stop talking about it. But I felt like I rushed into it and I didn't know everything and,
Well, don't worry, because nothing about this movie is rushed. Like, it is a...
It takes its sweet-ass time.
And I think that's a good thing.
It is.
For the movie, for the story they were telling.
For an epic, you want that.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it as well. I enjoyed that I didn't know what was going on and that they just slowly fed it to me over... And I'm still not sure what's going on. I am going to watch it again. You and I have plans to trip to the theater.
That's right.
And see this, I think, kind of as it was intended.
Yeah, the first time I watched it on my laptop and then... Yeah. And then I upgraded and watched it with
TV.
You to the TV. And
in
now
the living
I'm going
room.
To the big screen.
And, yeah. I think this movie, the way the sound design is and just the scope of the shots, it looks like a movie that is built for a theater. And I am not, just to clarify, we are not being those Twitter guys who are like, if you watched it on HBO, you didn't really watch it.
But like, if you watch it, no, I'm,
you know, like, I
watch what you're comfortable with.
Exactly. We're going to try and go to a sparsely populated showing. We're going to try and pick one of those out. It'd make me a little more theater. This will be my first theater experience in almost 2 years.
I think Baby Driver was the movie that really showed me, like, the importance of watching something like in a theater.
Being, yeah. Not that that's a bad movie at home.
No.
You know, I think some
is bad at home.
But I think just, some are. Yeah, I think there was a slew of 3D movies that was the only thing that they had going for them that was that they were in 3D.
Jaws 3D.
Yeah, going way back, yeah. But yeah, I really enjoyed Dune. I thought the character work was amazing. I thought the cast was so good.
Mm-hmm.
The tone, the visuals, Denis Villeneuve. I'm sorry. I know I'm probably, I can never pronounce that name.
It's the Fibonacci code. It's sequence.
Yes. It is very much his style of things that I've seen, like Arrival and Blade Runner 2049. It is that slow pace and those just beautiful visuals. And I think this movie was really kind of an experience, and I'm really looking forward to going and trying to dissect it a little bit more with a rewatch.
It's hard to describe what watching this movie feels like, but it's like it's a mix, like it's an action movie for sure, but it also feels like a political drama.
Yeah, no, it is. It's very much a kind of political thriller. There are action sequences, and I would equate it very much to like a science fiction Game of Thrones, where it is about different houses fighting for control of an empire and resources. And in between the political talk, there are fighting scenes, you know, like right. There are like battle scenes. It's kind of like that, but yeah, it is kind of hard to nail down exactly what it is. I guess plot-wise, it's fairly simple, but just this movie is so much more than just the plot. And forgive me if I'm sounding fumbling with this, because I'm not a Dune guy. I've not read the book,
mm-hmm.
And so like I know this is probably like old hat to the Dune heads out there.
Just know that a fake fan is talking.
I am becoming a Dune convert with this movie. But yeah, in trying to just say like what this movie, you know, what the experience of this movie is. This movie felt like meditating to me. It felt like I'm very much in it. I'm very focused on what is happening right now without trying to look forward or back and just sort of try to be with the movie. And the slow pace and the length of the movie made it feel like after a while I was kind of fading in and out. Like if I meditate too long, my mind kind of goes in and out of it.
Yeah.
It felt very, I equate it very much to the way I meditate. It very much felt, I came out of this movie a little hazy, a little here. And just like, I'm like, what just happened? Like it was a little, it's pretty intense actually. It's
being in tune, but also
zoned fading out. In and out.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's actually, to bring up another movie, same filmmaker, it is a lot like, it felt a lot like Blade Runner 2049. Different story, same tone and kind of visual experience that I had with that movie.
Sure.
And I saw that movie for the first time in the theater and was very glad that I did. So that was part of what put me over the top of wanting, you know, hitting you up and going, hey, do you want to go see this again?
Right.
And like, let's go see this big. You know,
I knew the moment I watched it the first time, I was like, damn it, I didn't go to the theater.
I like that we were able to feel it out at home first, though. You know, it's like, this didn't cost us anything extra to watch Dune at home. And it was one of those where I'm like, I'll watch it at home, and if it really is that demanding for a big screen for me, I'll find a way to go see it on a screen. So, yeah, I don't feel like I lost anything by not seeing it on the big screen the first time. But I do want to see it. I do want to see it in that setting.
Right.
You know.
Another, speaking of movies that are in theaters right now, one that is...
Jungle Cruise.
Leaving soon.
Oh, you did see that. I forgot.
You're trying to make a joke about a who would watch Disney that movie? But I am, in fact, the target audience of that movie. I am going later tonight, actually, to see Last Night in Soho.
Oh, yeah.
Edgar Wright's new film with Matt Smith in it.
Matt Smith and Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yep. It looks really interesting.
I have been hearing some really, really good things. Yeah.
Time travel and trippy sequences. Yep. Horror and serial killers.
Suspense, serial killer. Time travel and serial killer. Gonna shout out Malcolm McDowell again. He comes up every so often on this show. He did a movie called Time After Time.
Okay.
In late 70s? Where he plays H.G. Wells, writer of The Time Machine, who actually has a time machine, and Jack the Ripper steals the time machine, and H.G. Wells chases him through time into, like, modern day.
Oh my god.
Great movie. Yeah.
That sounds somehow in the same realm as, like...
Very weird, yeah.
Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Slayer.
It's like, not, like, this it's, self-aware, it's history, but yeah, but it's, like it,
weird.
It's a suspense mystery through time. It's, right. Yeah, it's pretty wild. But yeah, Last Night in Soho, you're going tonight?
Yeah.
Cool.
Excited for it.
I would be too. Yeah, man, wish I wasn't working. But tough. That looks really good, and it looks like something kind of different for Edgar Wright, which I'm very curious to see how he does this type of movie. He made a documentary that came out earlier this year. Edgar Wright is like doing some interesting other things.
Yeah. No comedy in this one, I don't think. So.
It doesn't look like a real laugh riot like the Coronado trilogy. But
stab someone and there's like just a soundtrack of laughter.
She's got a cricket bat just bashing Matt Smith in the head. Like
you've Shaun got red dead. On you.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and a big year for Anya Taylor-Joy. Love her. She's great. I got nothing else to say because I haven't seen it yet, but you'll have to...
Neither have I.
You'll have to come back and tell us how it was.
It should be on my Twitter. I'll let people know.
Awesome.
But that's not what we watched for the show this week.
That's not.
For the show this week, we return to Gotham. We watched 2008's The Dark Knight. In this movie, it's been a few years since the League of Shadows has terrorized Gotham, and Batman is still doing the dirty work of cleaning up the streets. But with thugs afraid to step out at night, and the new district attorney, Harvey Dent, locking up what looks to be the remains of Falcone's crime syndicate, again from the last movie, Bruce Wayne is considering retirement. That all changes, though, when the Joker, a dangerous criminal anarchist, rises to the forefront and convinces the criminals of Gotham to take on Batman. This movie, once again, is directed by Christopher Nolan and stars Christian Bale, Heath Ledger, Gary Oldman, Aaron Eckhart, and a lot of other people.
Yep. Maggie Gyllenhaal, Michael Caine is back, Morgan Freeman is back.
The usual cast. I tried to get who the newer kind of characters in this are.
Eric Roberts plays Sal, the Italian crime boss.
Right.
Who's like taken over Falcone's thing. Yeah. Great cast.
It is a great cast. And we talked last time about the recast for Rachel.
Right.
We have...
Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Taking over for Katie Holmes.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of that? Better or worse? Or the same?
Hard to tell. Honestly, like, upon reflection, this is the Rachel Doss that I remember, because this is the movie I've seen more.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually think I liked the first performance better. Like, there's something more, like, innocent to her character, like...
Yeah.
Which I guess says something about this Rachel. Like, this Rachel, I feel like, could fend for herself if she was in the right situation. Like, when she steps up to basically tell the Joker to fuck off during that party scene.
Yeah, but the first... Katie Holmes kind of did, too. Like, she was getting ready to shoot that guy that time. She had her taser out on the subway.
That's true.
She's not incapable. I just don't like... I think I decided on this watching that I just don't like Rachel as a character.
You don't like her add-in to this universe?
I don't know if it's Maggie Gyllenhaal or the way the character is written in this movie. She's whiny. She's a little naggy. She's sort of like the worst written version. It's sort of like the thing that people complain about female characters being written as. I feel like she's kind of all of those things. She is the weird motivator for the hero, and she's naggy and she's whiny and she complains a lot. And I don't know. I find her like super annoying in this movie.
It's shallow.
I think in the first movie, it works a little better because she's not as front and center. And she sort of like, I think she's written a little better. She sort of calls him out on his selfish rich boy bullshit. And I don't know. Something about it feels a little more capable and she feels a little more interesting. And I just think Maggie Gyllenhaal's like, yeah, I'm the girl boss, and I'm going to take on the mob with my new boyfriend, Harvey Dent. And, like, but she doesn't really do anything. She just kind of, like, still is shaming Bruce, and...
She's literally a trophy. Like, the whole thing of her screen time in this movie is, oh, is she going to choose Harvey over Bruce?
Yeah.
Is she going to wait for Bruce?
Right. And she's like, oh, you know, then she just, I don't know. She's irritating to me. She's kind of, I think, maybe the worst part of this movie.
Well, don't worry. She's not breaking out of that fridge anytime soon. We're all good there.
No, she's not. She is on ice. Yeah, new Rachel, but worse Rachel, I think.
Worse Rachel.
And I don't know if I want to hang that on Maggie Gyllenhaal or if that character was just written worse in this. I don't think Maggie Gyllenhaal does much with the character. So I don't think she, like, elevates what was written. I don't think she does a great job with it. I just don't think it worked for me.
Right. I think the one... I think the really genuine moment... And part of this is a 2.5-hour movie. There's a lot of movie in this movie.
There is a lot of movie.
And... there's not a lot of time just given to, like, make characters, but I think it's at Bruce's party where he gives a speech. It's his fundraiser for Harvey. And he's on the balcony, and Rachel goes out there and is like, you know, Harvey doesn't know you
enough. Yeah, she's such a bitch to him.
I love that.
You really?
That's exactly how, like, childhood friends, like, talk. Like, you can go up to them at any point and it's like you've never spent time apart. You can just be like, hey, you're being an asshole right now.
But he wasn't being an asshole.
But that's,
he went in there and, like,
because it was out of character for him. This was a good moment for Bruce, and she genuinely did not see it until he was like, no, I'm being serious. And then she believed him. Like she didn't keep going on about it. She was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, but the whole thing, I thought she was being a bitch, because I don't think he did any... I don't think he was being an asshole. He got off the helicopter, and he strolled in like an asshole with three women on his arm. But then he, like... I like how he comes in and just immediately goes into a speech.
Oh, it's... I've never noticed so many things about this movie, and that was one of them.
He walks in, he's like, oh, hey, everyone, it's Harvey Dent, and I saw those TV commercials.
And well, like, I still have your attention. I'm
gonna... It's just sort of like so awkward. But yeah, no, I thought if they're going to focus on this aspect of that, they wanted to make him seem like an asshole, instead of him being like, we're going to elevate Harvey because we truly believe in him, it could have been more focused on the idea of, I want to elevate Harvey so that I can quit being Batman and go be with Rachel. Which, it is mentioned, but I don't ever feel like that is his, like, real motivation. That could have been so much more interesting to focus on and have Rachel be actually a part of that story.
Right, like, knowing that that's what he's doing.
Knowing that that was just his end game, and that's the only reason that he really... But then it's like, oh, he really does believe in this guy. Which... almost detracts from it, but you almost, I don't know, it's a weird thing. I'm not trying to rewrite the movie, I'm just saying, like, these parts with Rachel and him and Harvey is this weird triangle. It just kind of didn't work for me.
It's really just there to set up the tragedy of Two-Face,
which they could have had without the girl.
Yeah,
like, it doesn't have to be that. They already have the triangle of... The more interesting three-way in this movie is him, Gordon, and Dent. Like, that's the more interesting triad, where nobody truly trusts each other, but they all are working together and starting to accomplish things. It's the more interesting triad, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Than having them sit in the restaurant and Bruce, like, call out Harvey's manhood because he likes ballet. Yeah, which,
seriously, which what is like, the
dude,
fuck?
You're there with a ballerina.
Like, yeah, but he's there to have sex with the ballerina. He's so, not watching your silly little shows.
It's so dumb. But,
it really, really, the, like, adult conversations in this, like, the drama, like, as a kid, I didn't, like, I was like, oh, wow, this is some really intense, like, I'm like, this is childish. This is so childish.
There is childish stuff in this movie, and I think I noticed it more because I was watching it, you know, watching it for the show, so you watch it more critically.
Right, it's like new eyes.
Right. So I don't want to harp on what I didn't like, which is mostly Rachel.
And I thought you were going to say most of it.
No, but, no, I mean, that's the other side of the coin.
Ooh.
Ooh. I love this movie still. You had in the show doc, you know, reassessing an old movie. I think this may still be my favorite comic book movie. I think it is epic, and it is a big story. It is a lot of movie, and that is dealing with a lot of actually really interesting themes and really interesting social issues. And I think this movie is endlessly interesting still.
It is.
2008. This movie is old now. I mean, seriously, like this movie is, it's weird to think how old this movie is. You know,
13 years old.
It doesn't seem like it came out that long ago, but I think it's held up really, really well. Over 13 years.
It has. First off, Batman Begins gave it such, like, a platform.
Yeah.
To build off of.
Oh, it had a great jumping off point.
Right.
With Batman Begins.
I feel like what makes this movie so great is You talked about the morals. Is that the word you
the
used?
Themes.
The
yeah.
themes. I always forget
well,
that
there's
word.
There's morality stuff in here as well.
Right.
Yeah.
But the themes of this movie, like, I feel like the last, again, Batman Begins, that was the setup. They were really just like, why do you need a vigilante? Let's justify that.
Right.
This movie is like the counter argument. It's basically like, okay, what are the reasons that having a vigilante is bad, but ultimately you still need one? And so we get basically the natural result of Batman beating the crap out of all these criminals is that they get scared and back behind someone more powerful. So right. upping the ante only serves to give evil people a reason to up the ante as well. Kind of like combat, you know, like they're going to rise to meet you.
Right, right.
So.
They touch on it at the very end, at like the epilogue of Batman Begins, where he meets Gordon on the rooftop and he's like, what about escalation? You know, we start wearing body armor. They start carrying armor-piercing rounds. You know, we have you. Now there's this guy. And that's where the idea of the Joker is introduced.
Right. They literally,
you know, like they lead into the Joker, and that it is escalation. That's why you talk about like Batman Begins being a jumping off point. Literally, I mean, this is a couple years later. I don't know if this is supposed to take place right after, but it seems like he's been being Batman for a couple of years.
I do believe that they
in like
they
the real
kind of
the real time
of
this movie,
years.
Yeah. But the idea that the escalation is already happening and that this is the culmination of that, like at the beginning of this movie, they do sort of talk about. The Joker has been a thing for a while. Like,
right.
Batman is sort of like starting to investigate him. And, you know, oh, he's showing himself in all these crimes and things like that. And then. Mm-hmm. Like,
and all the Joker kind of thugs, they are asking questions about him because he's like the trending topic.
He's like an urban legend almost.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that at the beginning. Let's talk about the very opening of this movie, the bank heist.
The setup?
Yeah. I think it's one of the great openings to a movie ever. I think it's really just a great, really exciting. I mean, it just starts with them punching a window out so they can, you know, zip line across the street. It's amazing.
Right.
Oh, they're doing like, James Bond shit right off the bat.
The first shot, and they're like, all right, let's lead you into this.
Yeah.
Down the line.
I love an action movie that throws you in the middle of the action and then lets you sort out what's going on.
Me too. And the whole reason I put in the notes reevaluating an old movie, and the reason I put that was the first thing that struck me about this movie that I noticed... Oh, I'm watching it more closely, is the Joker reveal where, you know, all of the bank robbers are killing each other.
Right.
And you assume that the Joker at the very end is going to get all the money, kill the last guy and like, moo-hoo-ha-ha, like dance over his pile of money. And instead he's there with them the whole time. The real
right.
Joker.
Right.
That reveal, like, I had seen it so many times, I forgot that was a reveal. Like, I think the last time I saw this movie, I just assumed you're supposed to already know that he's there.
Yeah. He's the guy that gets picked up on the street on the way to the job. He's the guy who gets in the back of the SUV.
Oh my God, see, I haven't even...
like, they show him from the back, and he's holding his clown mask and the bag over his shoulder. That's him. And
God.
I think it's great. I think it's great the way they weave all that in. They cut between the guys in the car talking about, I heard he wears makeup, you know, and then the guys out, they cut to the guys on the roof and they're doing the same thing. Why do they call him the Joker? You know, and then I love that they're just planting the seeds that he is a guy, and he's a mysterious guy of mysterious origins, and that runs the whole movie. You never know where he comes from.
Right. This is a Joker without an origin story.
Yeah.
We don't know about the vat of acid. We don't know if this Joker even knows what acid is.
I think this Joker knows what acid is.
Probably. I never realized the, want to know how I got these scars? Like,
yeah.
That is in itself like a reference to the fact that he doesn't have an origin story. Because every time he tells that story, it's a different story.
Right.
He's making it up. He either doesn't know his origin, or really, I think what the movie's trying to say is that it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Yeah.
It doesn't matter about the man. This is just a man who wants to incite chaos.
In the same way that Batman Begins talked about Batman being more than a man, I feel like that's what the Joker is. The Joker is like chaos embodied in this person. It doesn't matter where he comes from or anything. This is just what he stands for, is chaos.
Right.
I also think it might kind of be a sort of nod to the comics, because the Joker has been around so long that his origin has been told so many different ways. You know, for a long time, he didn't have another name. And then they showed, like, mm-hmm. Oh, no, he's this guy. And, like, in The Killing Joke, he's this guy. He's the Red Hood at one point. Like, it is all, you know, it's messy.
Right. Sometimes he has an abusive father. Sometimes he has a girlfriend.
Right. Sometimes. Yeah. It's all of these things. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. I love that they make this guy. And I think people are split on this portrayal of the Joker. Everybody likes Heath Ledger's performance is great. It's amazing. He won an Oscar, even though he was dead already. Like, it was just like this huge thing. But there are people who, like, they don't like these movies. They're a little too dark. They're not fun. They're not comic book. You know, they want it to be more like the animated series,
I do get that.
Yeah, I get it too. Like, it's to each his own. Everybody has their own flavor that they prefer. But I love
and
that
we
they
just happen to be the only people who are right about what flavor is
exactly,
the best.
Exactly right. I love that they make this guy just an unreliable narrator in his own life. That's how chaotic he is. And that he is not about money. He's not about anything but chaos. And he is a pure anarchist.
It's kind of like the reverse of the message of Into the Spider-Verse. Anyone can be Spider-Man. It's anyone can be this evil monster that just incites chaos.
Anyone kind of could be, yeah. And
yeah.
Which is, I think, more the point of, like, the new Joker movie.
Unlock your inner chaos, people.
But, no, I love this portrayal of the Joker. And I love that aspect of him, that he's sort of larger than life to the point that nobody can figure out where he comes from or who he really is. Even when they arrest him and Gordon's like, no, his fingerprints don't match, his dental
custom
work doesn't
clothes.
Match, he's no labels on his clothes, he has no ID, like, who is this? It just
which
I love this mystery of who is this guy. It's not in the foreground for this entire movie, but it's always in the background, and they never answer it.
Right.
Which I love it.
It makes the Joker into, like, this big, like, mythical. He could do anything.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because, like, in that, in close to the end where he sets the dogs on Batman, and then he's just, like, running around them, like,
yeah,
throwing a few kicks in. That's when I really realized, oh, this is a weak little man.
Yeah.
This is, Batman could take him and snap his neck in a second. Like,
he does it in the penthouse, in the party scene, too. Mm-hmm. Like, he's throwing his henchmen at Batman, and then like, when someone else is holding Batman's arms is when he gets, like, the knife out of his shoe.
And then stabs starts
kicking at him. Like, when someone else has... It's like, he's got guns, he's got explosives, and he's smart. But he, like, he could never, like, fist fight. And he even says at the end, he's like, what do you think? I bet the soul of this city on a fist fight with you? Like, he knows. He knows he can't do that. But, like, it's really, really interesting to see that at the end of the day, like, he's not a combatant like that. Like, he's good with guns. That's about
right. He's like a mastermind.
He's a planner. Right.
Who is against schemers. Right, because his whole speech on schemes.
Yeah.
Batman, Gordon, they're all schemers.
The whole thing,
But that's the anarchy. People have this perception of what life and society is, and he's there to be like, no, you can do anything you want. You can be as weird and...
Right.
Ugly and monstrous. Right.
Stop doing what you think you're supposed to do. Which is like, I think one of the appeals of this character is he kind of gets you on his side because he makes like these grand speeches about like, we hear it all the time in other things today. These are just constructs. These are social constructs. They don't mean anything, you know, about this, that, whatever. We talk about society having constructs. And that's basically what he's saying. He's like, nobody cares if a bunch of gangbangers get shot. But if a bunch of soldiers that you don't know get blown up, everybody freaks out. You know, like,
yeah.
Like we care about these combatants, but not these combatants. And we, it's a really, like, he's making these points that I think are people kind of understand, like, oh, why don't we value human life the same way? Why don't we? And the whole point when he's talking to Batman, to your point about like making arguments for and against vigilantes, you know, and he's saying like, they've been more than happy to have you around until now. Right. Now, when they're inconvenienced by it, they don't like you anymore. And they won't like you when they don't need you anymore.
Look at how quickly they turn.
Like, they've already turned on you. And, like, he's making this real solid point that he designed.
Yeah.
You know, but, like, it is true. Like, we see this kind of thing in real life all the time.
And that's how easy it works as a manipulation, because you take the faults of the system and you kind of like, it's like a slippery slope fallacy. It's like, oh, well, isn't this and this and this weird? Well, then everything society has ever told you is a lie and you should go around murdering people.
Right, yes.
And it's like, maybe let's, you know, ease up on some societal rules that don't have any value, but like, let's still keep our moral principles.
Right. But that's the thing that he's tapping into. It's just these broad ideas about things like that. And I think it hits home in a way that you can kind of go, oh, I can see. It's like like cult leaders who are able to tap into what people need to hear. And you go, yeah, that guy's, you know, wackadoo, but I get how that can be appealing to somebody, you know, yeah. What I mean? Which is really interesting to see the way it's laid, the way this character is written and the way that Ledger plays him as this sort of charismatic, I mean, clearly insane face paint, but like, he's also got this real clear line of thought that goes through his head.
It's somehow like, he really embodies the clown part. Not in like a campy, silly way, but right. Just like...
He's not Cesar Romero from the old TV show. But
he's got that not taking himself seriously.
Right.
Kind of just being there. Like, this is the message.
And There's Alan Watts talk, and it's all about like these Buddhist ideas that nothing matters, Like, the whole idea of, like, stop taking everything so seriously. Nothing matters. And this is that philosophy, but, like, extreme. And the way that, like, Fight Club is, like, extreme Buddhism. You know, like, extremist Buddhism. Yes. You know, like taking these ideas and taking them to a violent degree. That's what this is doing, too, is taking these ideas of, like, don't take everything so seriously, and taking that idea so seriously that you're actually blowing up half the city, you're burning giant piles of money, and you're just murdering people left and right.
Hell yeah.
And you kind of root for the Joker through this. I mean, it's bizarre. Oh, wait, was that just me?
Yeah, hello, psych ward. We're going to need you to pick up. Speaking of that, there is a scene where I realized, oh, I'm not supposed to be rooting for the Joker in this scene. And that's where he's trying to kill Harvey Dent, where they're chasing through the lower levels of the road. What is that called?
Yeah. Where they're... The car chase.
Yeah. And he's got the bazooka and he's aiming. Like, there's no music in that scene. It's just tension and you see a goal. And so I was just like, yeah, hit him. And then Batman stops it and I'm like, aw.
It's a great scene.
It is a good scene.
That might be the... Man, there's so many... there's so many great big set pieces in this movie. But I think that middle, it again seems like the end of the movie, but that middle car chase, that really is like the halfway point of the movie.
Yeah.
I think that really is like the best set piece. It's such a great chase. It's shot so well and it covers so much ground and so much violence. I think it really, everything about that just comes together and holds the tension through the whole thing.
Right. You said that felt like like the end of the movie.
It felt like it should have been the big action scene that ends the movie.
Right.
That resolves everything.
Well, there are like 10 of those.
Yes.
Because here's what I think it is. This movie, like, it's got a bunch of pieces. It's like a puzzle. That's just kind of how Christopher Nolan does his thing. But, like, it tricks you into every set piece. The puzzles come together. And you're like, oh, now it all makes sense. And then the end of that scene somehow changes the context of everything. Or leads to the next thing. And,
right.
And so then they come apart again, and then the pieces have to come together in a new way.
Well, it's almost like a video game, in that, like, once you accomplish a level, you just move on, and it doesn't really affect much going forward. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, the one I think of, it, like, the bank scene at the beginning. It just kicks off the movie. But once they're done with that, like, the money's in play. But nobody's sitting there talking about, like, oh, what about the bank heist? Like, nobody cares about the bank heist.
Yeah,
the exactly. Only thing that carries over for the bank heist is that the Joker is using that shotgun that he took from the bank manager for the rest of the movie. Like,
holy shit. You're not going to do this to me. What? You looked up trivia, didn't you?
No.
How do you notice that?
Because I watched it with a critical eye this time, and when he comes into the penthouse, when they come into the fundraising party, and he shoots in the air, that's the shotgun. When he shoots the cop from the semi, when the cop's like, hey, you can't park here.
Yeah.
And he pops up, that's what he shoots him with. It's the same sawed-off shotgun.
Holy shit.
I think he loses it after that, but he does have it throughout there. Oh, you wait and see some of the other things I picked out of this movie.
Oh, that's great.
but yeah, nobody is talking about that. When Batman goes to China and kidnaps Lao and brings him back, that's it. They just move on. They're like, okay, we got him now.
Which, by the way, that's kind of funny. We got international Batman in
we
this
did.
Movie.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like a whole movie. It wasn't like Wolverine 2 where he goes... Like that's the Asian Wolverine.
Right. The one, what was that movie? Was it The Wolverine?
It's the second Wolverine movie.
Where he goes to Japan. It is like its own little heist that they drop in the middle of this movie, which is great. And I love that scene, by the way. I think it's so much fun. But it is such a weird thing that they put all this energy into him going to China and Morgan Freeman, talking the deal through and then setting up the sonar in the building. And then the big scene where he flies through the air, kidnaps him, gets hauled out on some weird James Bond CIA trip. And then, that's it. We're not bringing up China or anything ever again. Lau comes back at the very end of the prison thing, but that's it. It's never really brought up again. And it's just sort of like they had these big set pieces that they do advance the story, but then we just move on from them. And it does feel like a video game, like you're just hitting levels all the way through.
Right. It's so weird because watching this with a critical eye, I pieced together the plot. Which it's kind of a simple plot.
Yeah.
But for some reason, the plot of this movie doesn't matter. Like, I don't care, like, what it's about. It's just an adrenaline ride. I'm just here for the 2.5 hours of dopamine that I'm going to get from the rising
from
of...
The
oh, okay, quick shots. Okay.
The up and down of it all.
Music.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, it's just perfectly put together.
It is. Everything, like you said, the puzzle pieces of the individual set pieces, and then those link together well. I'd say the only big action scenes that fall flat are the third act ones. The building, the hostages in the building, and the boats. That stuff it falls pretty flat for me.
Really?
Yeah, the boat stuff, it's fine. I get why it's there. Mm-hmm. It's important to the plot, but it feels like, do you remember when those dudes, on the bridge in Sam Raimi's Spider-Man start throwing shit at the Green Goblin? They're like, don't mess with Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Like, that's what it feels like to me. It's like these guys, like everybody's like overacting and being like, well, they had their chance. Let's blow them to hell. And it's just like. Seriously? Like, this is what...
There's no nuance to
No,
it.
It's really, like, getting clubbed over the head with mm-hmm. it. But I get why it's there. And it is, like, super important to the end game of this movie.
Yeah.
But, like, it just comes off a little bit cheesy. And that... The other one with the fake doctors and the fake hostages. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that one just, it almost feels like, oh, we got to resolve this hospital shit. Just, you know, throw this together. And it's done with the weird sonar vision, which is disorienting, and it's just a little much.
That is kind of the point of the movie every time where I, like, check out a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, okay, yeah. Okay.
Third act problems.
Sure. One thing, I swear to God, I've never realized this. The Joker is caught with, like, no ceremony to it, and then, like, we never see him again, ever, and knowing that Heath Ledger dies, like, okay, but, like, I feel like the story didn't end. Does that make sense? Because the way the movie does it is we're in that third act,
mm-hmm.
okay, Batman pushes Joker off.
Mm-hmm.
And then, instead of letting him die,
right.
he catches him.
Brilliant.
And the Joker has the last laugh by telling him that he's not going to kill him. And he's just going to escape again. And they'll be doing this forever. Because he's having too much fun to kill him. And Batman's dumb for not killing him.
I think you missed it. I think you missed the...
He
really wanted was for Batman to kill him.
I know.
So he didn't win?
What do you mean?
He didn't win because Batman didn't kill him.
Right, but, like, they took Joker off the board, and it's in this way that's meant to imply that he's not off the board, really. Like, that's his thing, is, like, he said, he basically says he's gonna return. Like, he implies...
Oh, yeah, no.
I really thought... I had the realization that they were probably planning for him to be the villain of the third movie, too.
I think...
And then he died.
To look ahead at the third movie, and I'm sure we'll get into this, when everybody escapes from Arkham, and Cillian Murphy, the Scarecrow, was, like, judging people. I feel like that was supposed to be the Joker.
Oh, really?
I kind of feel... I don't know if this was written yet or not. I remember there is a animated series episode where all the prisoners of Arkham are, like, holding court, and the Joker is the judge. He's got a big powdered wig on and shit. I do feel like he should have been holding court and holding judgment over. But regardless, yes, they do imply that... That just, I think it is sort of the implication that they're the two sides of the coin. They, you know, the whole thing of, like, you complete me, you know.
Right, this, and this they'll kind just of thing. Keep going right. forever.
But I don't think that means he won. I think the winning is in Batman not, you know, saving him. And saying you're going to go to the padded room, you know, instead of, you're not getting off that easy. Because when he kicks him off the building, Heath Ledger is so great. That's such a great moment. He laughs all the way down. He's like, he did it! He did it! You know, like, and that maniacal laugh he does as he's falling. Like, I got him to do it. That's like yeah. what that laugh is saying. And, you know, like, I love that.
He's the little sibling that
he's like,
just...
I did it. I can't believe he actually threw me off the building. This is great.
He annoyed his older brother yes. into punching yeah. him, and then he's gonna yeah, then run he's gonna and tell mom.
Go and tell. Well, middle child, is that anything you have experience with?
You know, I relate with a lot of characters in this movie.
But I think it's I just think it's such a great moment, and him catching him just displays how much he wanted to die. It's what's the Batman Under the Red Hood, the the animated film. There's a slightly similar tone to the ending of that and the Joker's in that, but yeah, I think he didn't win. He just lived, and it's almost like saying like Batman won this round. But yeah, it is implied that this is his greatest nemesis, and they're gonna do this over and over again.
It just felt like, I don't know, like this movie was so good, and I just, even though I've seen it a billion times and I'll see it a billion times more, I was like, I was sad and reminded that this is the only that I'm going to get. I'm not going to get any more Heath Ledger Joker versus Christian Bale Batman.
There's, I think Heath Ledger, like, really surprised a lot of people in doing this.
I knew he was, like, an unpopular pick.
Yeah.
And then became the best.
As, when I did 1989 Batman on Hit Me One More Time, David played a game where he would read... shit-talking quotes about a Batman casting, and we had to guess which Batman or Joker or whatever they were talking about. Because, like, this has just gone on forever. You know, even, like, pre-Twitter, pre-internet stuff.
I hated him in Twilight. Christian Bale was in Twilight? What?
But I sent you a video this week where someone was asking Christian Bale about what he thought about Robert Pattinson taking it.
Right.
And I think Christian Bale was, like, so great about being, like, he goes, he's a super interesting actor, and I think he's going to do some amazing things with it, and I hope he just takes it and makes it his own. And he even acknowledges, he goes, everyone hated when Heath was cast, too, and look what he did with that. So, like, Christian Bale had like a huge respect for Heath Ledger with what he did with this movie. So I think
I can tell.
I think it really, after this came out, everybody was bummed that he had died by the time this movie came out. But when it came out and everybody saw how good he was, and everybody was like, oh shit, man, we could have got him for another movie and we're not going to anymore.
It's so sad.
I mean, the whole thing is sad. Accidental overdose is horrible. Drug addiction is, you know, just awful. But like, yeah, it robs us of like great art too. And it just is, you know, not to sound like selfish about it, but I don't know him. Drug addiction in general is terrible, but like, it's not like a personal loss of a friend, but it is a loss of an artist that you're watching.
No, that's truly justified to be like, as a consumer, here is what we missed out on.
Appreciated the work that he was doing here. Yeah. I had just one thing I wanted to hit on in talking about like ambiguous pasts. We get a little glimpse of Alfred's past in this movie, which I really like too.
Oh yeah, where he talks about the jewel thief.
He had some shady, I'm gonna say shady job working for some the Burmese government.
Is that what that's to imply?
It seems like he was working with the government on something, and they were tracking. He was some sort of mercenary or something. Alfred was some kind of badass commando or something in his youth. I don't know.
What I've always taken from that, I guess, was that he was like a soldier. I assumed he was like British.
Yeah.
And like a British soldier in, I've always pictured India. Like, it's like I just think like that's
colonization the kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
It could have all been connected to something. Yeah. He could have gone to India and, you know, ended up, you know, freelancing or something. I like that it's ambiguous, but it does imply that he was some sort of badass that was, yeah. you know, when he just says, I was working for this government and we were tracking a jewel thief and we ended up burning down the entire forest to kill this
like,
guy.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
And it is just sort of like, damn, man, like you committed some war crimes over it. Like, but I love that. I love this little glimpse of this proper English gentleman. It's like finding out like your parents were real people.
Right.
You know, like this guy you've known as this sort of quiet, very proper man, like he got blood on his hands at some point in his life.
That's kind of the thing with Alfred, is to make you forget that he's a badass, and then they just spring it on you with like a funny one-liner.
Yeah, I like that. I like that aspect of that. I don't want an Alfred Origins movie. I don't want like some long story that, you know, details all of his life. I like a little glimpse like that.
Right.
I just think that's so well done.
An Alfred movie, you say?
It's probably happening.
Hi, Hollywood Studios.
Let's write it.
Let's do it. I think one more thing I want to touch on before we go. I'm sorry to say, Commissioner Gordon is dead.
What?
Oh, sorry. No, he's not. Your emotions were toyed with for no reason. This was a fake out, and fake outs are weird.
I feel like, yeah, they could have had him. Fake outs are weird. I don't hate it. But it seemed unnecessary.
I will say I prefer this one to, I'll compare it to Nick Fury dying in Captain America, Winter Soldier.
Winter Soldier, yeah.
Yeah, because in that he again has to pretend that he's dead after an assassination attempt to to, you know, keep everyone safe. It's,
right.
It's the same exact premise for why this fake out is a fake out. But what they do, they explicitly show him dying on the operation table and everyone mourns and all that. This, they just kind of keep going, and his death actually becomes like a motivator. But for the most part, like, it's talked about with a few of the characters, like, Gordon died for this, or Gordon's gone. But, like, it's never really,
they
like...
go to his wife's house and, like, tell his wife that he died. His family. Like, scar his children.
I know. I was like, I would never do that. That's, like, ridiculous.
It's like, you didn't even tell your wife you were gonna fake your death? Like, are you out of your mind?
No, I...
Yeah.
Just wanted to,
just wanted to traumatize everybody.
Yeah. Why is he divorced in the next movie?
He is. On that same note, here's something else I noticed. Coming back around to things I noticed this time. James and Barbara Gordon named their children James and Barbara Gordon.
Uncreative.
Very. Isn't that weird?
Yeah. I didn't know that.
I rolled it back three times when they go to...
Where does it say that?
When they go to her house,
mm-hmm.
or go to Gordon's house after he dies, I'm air quoting, she opens the door and is like, oh no. And the cop goes, I'm sorry, Barbara, or something like that. And I rolled it back three times and turned on subtitles to make sure they said Barbara. Because... I don't think they ever say the daughter's name, but Jim Gordon's daughter is Barbara Gordon. Like, canonically. That's Batgirl. That's
Batgirl, yeah.
Oracle later on. Like, and she does tell Gordon's son, go inside, Jimmy. So it's like, the wife's name is Barbara. And, you know, you've got James Jr. and Barbara Jr. What is going on in the Gordon household? It's so strange. It's
really weird. What if the older Barbara became Batgirl instead?
My God, how weird. It really, like...
That is weird. I didn't...
Yeah, I don't think I ever caught that before, but that's so strange.
Talk about lazy.
Super lazy. What else I got here? Batman goes to a techno club like he's Neo. That was weird.
Should.
Yeah. The last standoff, speaking of the Gordon children, I love it. I like the final scene with Two-Face, that it's all coming together. They're trying to salvage it. It's just a great tense standoff.
It is. That scene where he starts pointing the gun and, like, Gordon's like, stop pointing that at my family. Yeah. And we've got a winner.
It's the boy. And the rest of his family's like, well, fuck you, Jim.
Jim like, really is sexist.
Jim's a dick. I just think it's a great standoff scene. And I think it's a great, they kind of cap off the movie without, being too heavy-handed with it. You know, they want to make sure. They're like, you know, why was I targeted? He's like, because you were the best. You were the legitimate guy who was going to do this. It wasn't me. It wasn't Gordon. It was you. You were the guy. And kind of makes him understand. And that, I think, just makes what happened to him, like, super tragic. Like, the whole tragedy of Two-Face is kind of its own movie. Like, that's his own story.
Within the story.
Like, Harvey Dent is boring for the first half of this movie, but that is made worth it once he gets all fucked up.
Right.
You know, like, it's a pretty ingenious way to make that character. Because he's pretty unlikable until you realize, like, oh, he really kind of was the savior. He was the guy.
This is the only, comic book movie where... there are more than one villain, and I'm not, like, hating it.
Yeah.
Like they do both parts justice.
They do it really, really, really well because they have one villain make the other.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's and that's kind of like they're battling for Harvey, because that's also who Batman wanted to be his right. replacement.
Well, it's like they do say it, like, the Joker says, like, something about they're battling for the soul of the city. And that yeah. is Harvey Dent, essentially. Like, he's the guy who can either clean it up or, you know, throw it all away. And I you know, Two-Face is, of course, like, the duality, you know, you split, you know, burned perfectly down the middle.
That's right. And,
but
that fire was a cosmetologist on the side. Yeah.
Great makeup effects, by the way, too.
It was.
I think those have really surprisingly held up really well.
What's weird is that isn't burned into my memory, because I totally thought that they weren't going to show it at all. That it was going to be bandages, like, yeah. or like cutaway, like, the whole time. And then they show it and I'm like, oh.
They do show it a lot. It is kind of surprising that he wasn't bandaged and then like have a big reveal at the very end.
Yeah.
But like, no, they just let him run around. And all I can think is like, man, that left eye has got to be so dried out. He has no eyelid. He has like no right. tear ducts. It's, man, that just drives me crazy. Takes a drink and it like runs out of the hole in his cheek. I'm like, this is really, it's really solid makeup.
There's a character in Doctor Who, bear with me.
My eyes are already glassing over.
She has plastic surgery to become the thinnest. She's like a trampoline.
Oh, and, I know that. Yeah, I've seen that one. Yeah.
And every few minutes she goes, moisturize me. And they gotta spray her. Yes. To keep her all nice and neat.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that one. You may I get that reference.
We just need to hire them for Two-Face.
And there you go. No, this was better than that.
Rude.
Sorry.
And with that horrible note, after you've trashed my favorite show, we are ending this episode and the podcast entirely.
Oh, wow. Total anarchy. Way to method act this one.
That's right. No, but we are moving on to shoutouts. Well, I guess we should first say what we think of this movie overall.
Okay.
Let's not jump the gun too much.
I already said it. I love this movie. I think this is one of the great comic book adaptations ever. And as much as people say Marvel's doing it right, DC is struggling to catch up, I think Marvel will never make a movie this good. And I'm not like a Marvel versus DC guy. You know, I'm not like trying right. to stoke that fire. I just think like Marvel makes a lot of really fun movies. I think this is a really fun movie that is also a great suspense movie. And I think its themes are solid. And I think it's just generally better written than what the Marvel formula typically does, which is very quippy.
Well, I think the whole thing is that we're making cinematic universes now.
It's apples and oranges. You're right.
Well, not even, like, this doesn't fit into a universe. There's a reason this isn't part of the Zack Snyder universe.
Right.
And there's a reason Marvel wouldn't make a movie like this, because it would stand out like a sore thumb. There's a reason they nitpicked Edgar Wright until he left.
That's a really, really solid point that almost like, this is too good to fit into either universe, because this kind of needs to stand on its own.
Right.
Like,
and that's not to say that the things that are in comic books or comic book movies cannot be at this level.
No, absolutely here they not. Are. I think that's a much better summary than me just trying to compare the two, because that probably was not a fair comparison either. I'm just saying, like, people who say that DC movies suck need to come revisit. I understand they're talking a lot of people default to DC EU. Shared universe or whatever they call it. The Snyderverse. but yeah, these are DC movies. This is the start of DC's mm-hmm. big budget movie career. This and like Superman Returns. I guess that probably came out around the same time, too.
Is that? Superman
Returns.
Was that before Man of Steel?
Yeah.
I don't it even was remember their, that
It was
happening.
Their first attempt to try to reboot Superman in movies, and nobody liked it. It's not very good.
But every time I hear a reboot failed, I'm like, oh, you guys really got your hopes up. And
yeah, I wish it had taken off, because then we got Zack Snyder.
Now thinking about it, how hilarious would a crossover between this Batman and Shazam...
I still haven't seen Shazam, but I get
totally
what you're saying.
They're
yeah.
so it would be awful.
So different.
I can't wait.
It is. I'm still stuck. Superman Returns. Yeah, I think that's it.
That sounds right.
The pedophile who made the X-Men movies made that movie.
Oh, nice.
Singer? Bryan Singer?
Yeah.
Is that his name?
That is his name.
Yeah. So we either get Bryan Singer, the pedophile, who makes good movies, or we get Zack Snyder, who apparently is, you know, not a sexual predator, but makes terrible movies. It's a terrible Sophie's Choice for Superman reboots.
Those are the only two directors we can choose from.
Just saying, like one or the other.
Superman, yeah.
No, but yeah, I to. Bring it back and summarize. I love this movie. Still, drawbacks and everything. I think as a whole, yes, 2.5 hours. This is a lot of movie, but I am never not entertained by it.
It's a movie that you. It takes up an afternoon.
Yes,
like this is you cannot watch any other movie.
I gave myself a big chunk of the day to watch this,
and it really like. We talked about, like, the separate, like, set pieces and, like, how things aren't brought up. It feels almost like a TV show in that sense. Like...
I think you could break this up and watch
really,
it in sections.
It could be.
Yeah.
This could be a miniseries.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be.
It's interesting.
But the momentum, I think, kind of demands that it be watched innocent. There is a momentum
to
this movie.
It would have to be a very different structure,
it
and
keeps
I think
rolling.
That would mess
yeah.
with the story. But... Basically, 10 out of 10 movie.
All right, 10 out of 10. High rating. Before we move on to shout-outs, I do want to... we did talk about comic adaptations last week.
Yeah.
And I got a message from Keith Gala of the Pop-Up Filmcast.
What does Keith have to say?
Keith told me to tell you, and I'll tell everybody, to check out Scott Snyder, not Zack Snyder, Scott Snyder's Batman run, Batman White Knight. Snyder wrote The Court of Owls, all that newer, New 52
yes.
stuff that we were talking about that we like.
I do love The Court of Owls.
I don't know White Knight, but I like what Snyder did with Court of Owls, and I am probably going to check it out.
White Knight. Interesting.
But I wanted to throw out there to our audience, if you could adapt a arc or a graphic novel of Batman, what would it be? What's your favorite? Is it Hush? Is it Long Halloween? Is it, and what style would you do it in? You can fantasy cast a director. I'll throw mine out there. I would like to see Court of Owls done in the Bruce Timm animation style, the style of Batman the Animated Series and Batman Beyond, somewhere in that. I'd like to see the Bat Family doing the Court of Owls arc there. Austin, you can answer next week, or you can if you have one ready to go today.
I don't have an arc to point to. But I'll just make up my own here, because I think my dream, I think my dream Batman movie would be, like, the main focus would be Batgirl versus Poison Ivy.
Interesting.
Those are just my favorite Batman universe characters.
All right.
But I feel like Barbara Gordon, I believe, is it the Court of Owls where she's, like, she has some sort of disability, and she's like a tech person.
She becomes the Oracle because she's paralyzed.
Yes.
From The Killing Joke, the Alan Moore graphic novel, The Killing Joke, where
right.
the Joker shoots her through the spine.
I couldn't remember the details, but I did remember that she becomes like the man in the chair.
Pretty much.
And so I just think her playing Robin to Batman and directing him against Poison Ivy. I mean, it could be in Christopher Nolan's like super realistic. She's like some sort of eco-terrorist who's trying to raise awareness by covering Gotham in poison.
It could be all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
But yeah, that's my pick.
All right. If any of you have a favorite arc or a direction you'd like to see Batman go cinematically, just wish list it. Just let us know. Give us a message at Phil Rude on Twitter or at Austin N. Rude on Twitter.
That's correct. You heard it here first, folks. Tweet at us, and we will make it happen.
That's right.
We do not have the power to do
we
so.
We do not
Please
have money.
Do not.
We are poor.
Please.
All right.
Shout outs. Let's do it. What do you have?
I have an artist I want to shout out. This is Erin O'Kelly. Her art page is Hag Attack. And Erin paints surreal horror children.
Interesting.
Her stuff reminds me of, like, if you ever go in, like, my grandparents, I guess it'd be your generation's great grandparents, that era of old person house, and they would have like little pictures, like paintings of children doing, you know, whatever. Just posing, standing, playing, whatever. Just these weird
like the
paintings.
Family portrait.
No, not even. It's a little more stylized than it. Like the big eyes. You ever see the, like those, that style of children? Erin does these with like body horror, like teeth coming out of eyeballs, a little girl holding all her guts in her hands. These horrific images that are also cute and surreal and really trippy. I just ordered a painting from her this morning. I just bought a piece from her. But she's great.
And it sounds very punk.
It is super. I think there's a super punk rock attitude with her. I'm going to give her Instagram page, and that will be linked in the show notes. It is hag_attack. And you can check out her work there that she's doing new stuff all the time. She's doing some smaller pieces right now that are going for a little bit cheaper on her site. And from her Instagram page, you can get links to her stores and see where you can buy things and help support her. She's an independent artist. People are talking a lot about the supply chain, a lot of shit sitting in boats, a lot of truck driver shortage is having trouble getting merchandise. Christmas is coming, holidays are coming. If you need to buy gifts, find local artists, find internet artists. This stuff is available, and you're supporting small businesses. And Erin is a great one, and I just want to shout her out as somebody who's really worth supporting, and her art is really trippy, really weird, and really great. And probably someone in your life would really appreciate a piece from her. So
that's a great message.
Give that a look. Give her a follow on Instagram, and check out what she's got going on over there.
All right, awesome.
What do you got, Oz?
I am going to promote a TikTok account. The URL is Tiny Jewish Girl.
Okay.
And, okay, how do I explain this? So, I don't actually know her name, but this woman, she dresses herself eccentrically.
Okay.
And it's impossible. Like, the things that she wears are, like, crazy patterns. And she just walks you through, all right, so I started with this, and I'm going to pair it with this. And then I'm going to bring these shoes in. But, like, her outfits, like, you know, Magic School Bus. You know Miss Frizzle?
Sort of, yeah.
Right. She looks like a normal person compared to this. to the point where, like, the comments of her videos are, like, filled with, like, is this satire? Like, what is going on
here? I love when people can't tell.
It's great. But, like, there are some people, like, oh my god, I love your fashion. It is interesting. It is fun to look at. It's inspiring. And I think it, even if you don't like her style, it challenges you to think outside the box.
Sure.
Of clothing as an art form, and you get to choose how you want to express yourself.
I think our stuff is a little bit connected, because sometimes creative things that aren't traditionally aesthetically what we're used to, can make you feel uncomfortable, can make you feel like, oh, this doesn't look right. But that if you kind of sit with it for a little bit, you kind of see it for what it is. It breaks away from what we expect, and you can kind of appreciate it in its own way. And I think a lot of Aaron's work that I was talking about is the same way. It's not normal, and it's going to make you a little uncomfortable. But if you sit with it for a minute, you really can grow a big appreciation for it. And I'm a big fan of art and creativity, like in clothing, like you're saying,
right,
as an art form.
Because we forget.
As costuming, just, yeah.
All right, I got to put a polo on for work or whatever. Like, you just wear what you wear. But
well,
like,
yeah, I mean, I specifically buy gray t-shirts and basketball shorts so I don't ever have to think about what I'm putting on.
But
I understand normal people actually put a lot of thought into that.
but yeah, I like expanding that boundary.
Yeah, that's really cool. I'm going to check that out.
Please do.
Tiny Jewish girl. All right. Well, we're going to thank you for listening to this episode of The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. If you enjoy our show, please leave a review on your podcatcher of choice. It helps our visibility. It helps us grow the show.
That's right. Another way to help us grow is to tell a friend. If you're going to do this, make sure that you don't tell them to rob a bank with you, because that's not what we're about. We're just a podcast about movies.
Don't kill your friends. Don't kill your friends after a bank job.
No.
It's just not cool.
Also, don't wear disguises around your friends. Don't.
Yeah. Be who you are.
Be who you are.
Yeah. I think we're all better people now.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah, isn't it?
Right. Well, next week we are finishing up the Nolan trilogy, watching The Dark Knight Rises. Or,
all right,
as I like to call it, The Dark Knight Falls on Its Face.
We'll talk about it.
All right. With that teaser of what the next episode is going to be, where can people find you on social media?
PhilRude.com is the hub for my artwork and this show. You can also get me on Twitter at PhilRude and on Instagram at PhilRude75. Austin?
You can find me on Twitter. I am Austin N. Rude, and I am old to review.
All right. Well, that does it for this week. Austin, you want to read the credits?
Yep. We did it all ourselves.
There you have it. We'll see you next time on The Picture Show.
See ya.
See ya.
Sometimes getting a good night's sleep is not just hard to do, but it's no fun either. That's why the fine folks at Slumber Party Mattresses have invested the time and money to make every bedtime a better solution for somnolence. Whether you're dozing, napping, or snoozing, getting some shut-eye or catching some Z's, Slumber Party has a scientifically enhanced mattress for you. Top options include the Catnapper, 40 Winks, the R.E. Emmington Steel, and the Eternal Rest. The last one can be converted to line your coffin, so even in the afterlife, you can sleep like there's no tomorrow. On top of that, each model is genetically modified to your specifically required repose. Never have another sleepless night and get a slumber party mattress today.